You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Blake and Ulig and United Auto Workers Local 249. Since 1972, Blake and Ulig has prided itself on providing comprehensive legal representation to labor organizations and their affiliated benefits funds on a local, regional, and national basis. And United Auto Workers Local 249 members building the best Ford trucks and vans in the world. The Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, it's all about railroad workers, their history, their negotiations, and their music. In the news, it's Workers' Memorial Day to remember that we still need to go home from work alive and well. And Starbucks workers and independents hold a sip-in. Our feature at the end of the show is Washington Window with Mark Grunberg. Now for the news. Today is Workers' Memorial Day. It's April 28th, and every year, the nation recognizes and pays its respect to those who lost their lives on the job. Last year, there were nearly 5,000 who died. We've had the Occupational Safety and Health Administration for over 50 years, but workers are still maimed and killed on the job because employers don't protect their safety. This year, OSHA recognizes deaths of healthcare workers, which rose 16% because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Today, OSHA had a very moving tribute, which you can find on their webpage. The theme of this year's commemoration is Dying Shouldn't Be Part of the Job. Safety is every worker's right. We'll have more on workplace safety later in the show and on the unsafety in Bessemer, Alabama at the Amazon warehouse. But for now, the news is focusing on the living, specifically Starbucks workers at the store near Independence Center. On Tuesday, the workers who are organizing with Workers United held a sip-in, inviting people to come in and order a union-strong coffee and sit down and sip it. The Heartland Labor Forum was there, and we sat down and talked to Megan LaRose, who was on break. She started at Starbucks in 2014 and quit a few times because of bad management and conditions. This time, she's been there since January. We asked if management was still bad.
Our management got a lot better. Our previous manager, she dealt with a lot of like racism and just bad time management, a lot of turnover. She's gone now. We have Kristen now, and she's been great up until our union election started.
Why? What has she done since then?
Well, once we got our election date, there's just been a lot of misinformation. It started out with we were like in this together, and she was going to stay neutral, and now it's turned into... And I know it's probably coming from above her, but now it's more just a lot of misinformation and trying to persuade people to vote no when that vote should be up to that individual person.
Can you give me an example of what kind of misinformation?
She's been telling us, and it's not just her, we have other stuff that gets posted in the back from corporate, but just being told that once we vote union, that our benefits won't be able to keep up, our wage won't be able to keep up, yeah, that she won't be able to help us on the floor anymore, which isn't true.
That depends on what you negotiate.
Yeah, it's up to us. It's not like up to an outside force, which is also what they like to say, that it's this outside party coming in. It's us. It's the workers. The union is their employees. It's us. Yeah.
One of the things that caught my attention was that Starbucks calls its workers partners.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like Walmart, I think, calls them associates. Everybody wants to call them something else besides workers. So what does a Starbucks partnership mean or with you guys?
So for us right now, Starbucks calls us partners because after you've been employed with them for a year, they will give you Starbucks stock, like it's just part of their benefits. So they're like, oh, you are a shareholder, so we're all partners. But as far as other than that stock, the partnership just doesn't really go any farther than that. Anytime we have ideas of our own to share with corporate about how to make things better for us, our customers, how things run, most of the time it's on deaf ears. There's no response to it. Not a very big partnership.
I turned to the woman next to me who had been nodding along with Megan and asked her who she is.
I'm her mother. And
what's your name?
Union. My name's Kathy.
And what union are you in?
Association of Flight Attendants. I retired from being a flight attendant.
Okay, and that's a strong union.
Yes, yes. And my son is in the IAM.
So you're a union family.
You betcha.
So are you the leader of this little drive here?
I wouldn't say I'm the leader. It's been a group effort. CJ, he was the first one that you talked to. CJ Miller and I, and then there's four other people on the organizing committee. And we've just been working on it together. Yeah.
You've been watching her with her career at Starbucks for quite a while now.
Yes, ma'am.
And what were you saying to her?
I kept telling her that the things that she would come home with that would be upsetting for her, I would tell her. I said, you know, if you had a union, this wouldn't be an issue. If you had a union, this wouldn't be an issue. And at that time, it was just something that I kept throwing out there because I'm union from birth, you know. And I just knew that she would be upset and frustrated with how the way things were being and how she was being treated or her coworkers were being treated. And I think finally it just sunk in that, yeah, I need to do something about it. And then she did.
Did you ever envision that Starbucks would be a career for you?
I didn't. It was a job that I took because it suited the needs I had going on at the time. But the more that I worked here, it's really just a good fit for me. Like the bond that I have with my coworkers, I love interacting with customers, I love coffee. It's just a place I've wanted to invest more time in. But it was hard to see that based on like our working conditions for so long, like the understaffing. Here's this metric that you have to beat, like in the drive-thru. Okay, you beat it. Now here's another one with no reward. So it was hard to actually see it going anywhere, but it's the people. It's my coworkers really that, coworkers and customers that make it seem, feel worthwhile.
So those are the primary issues that have brought you and your fellow workers to organize that you just mentioned?
That's some of them, yeah. That's some of them. Most of it is just, it's, you know, living wage, having a say at the table. And it's like most of the pandemic, we had no say in how things were done. The summer of 2020, they were wanting to open us up to full operations, and they never petitioned any of our opinion on it. It was a decision being made over our heads.
Are wages bad here?
They're better than some other places, but they're not suitable. They're not.
Like, how much do you make?
I make $15.24 an hour.
After how many years?
7. Yeah.
And somebody that's been here less than you, Kev, is making more, if I'm correct.
That happened prior. So that was part of the reason why I quit back in August, is I found out that there were two men supervisors that were promoted after me and had less time with the company, making, at the time, like 80 cents plus more an hour than I was. And when I confronted my management about it, I was told nothing could be done about it. And so that led to me quitting also.
So do you think this is sex discrimination?
I do. Yeah, I do. At the time it was. I was different. The store manager at the time was different then, but the district manager's been the same. And I do feel like it was motivated that way.
You mentioned there used to be issues with racism. Has that been taken care of? Or I noticed that I think all the employees I see right now are white.
The majority of our staff is white. We have a couple of people of color. There's, but anytime we have a black partner, they're not here very long. Yeah. They usually deal with a lot more harassment, a lot more nitpicking on their scheduling or their dress code, and they usually end up getting pushed out, and our most recent one was fired.
If you win, when is your election, by the way?
So our ballots went out yesterday, but then our ballot count count is May 24th.
So it's a month from now,
yeah.
Basically.
Yeah.
And if you win, which it sounds like, how many people sign cards?
We have over 80% that have signed cards and more than that that have said yes since then.
This is turning into a real movement, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's great. So if you win, what are you going to be your priorities, you think, at the negotiating table?
First of all, living wages. We have a lot of people that are like food insecure or struggle to make rent, relying on our cash tips that are usually just like 80 cents extra an hour. They don't really make up that much, but people rely on that for food every week. So living wages, definitely a wage increase. And seniority pay, because we have a lot of the few long-term partners we have, they don't make much more than someone that just started yesterday.
So some kind of benefit for seniority. Do you think Starbucks cares about having long-term employees?
It sure doesn't feel like it. They say that they love to rehire long-term partners. I've experienced that, but as far as the compensation for that, I've never seen it. Yeah, I feel like long-term partners, in a sense, get exploited because they are paid the same, but they're expected to operate at that higher level without any compensation for it.
I've heard that Starbucks has good benefits. Is that true?
They are if you can afford them, and they are if you can get scheduled enough hours to actually qualify for them.
So they're dependent on whether or not you're, like, full-time? Is that it?
They do part-time, but they will schedule people under the 20 hours a week. There's a lot of our staff is under 20 hours a week, yeah.
Because they have education benefits, right?
They do, yeah.
You have to be more than the 20 hours a week to get those?
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
Thanks.
That was Megan LaRose and her mother, Kathy, at the Starbucks near Independence Center. And this has been the news from our side. I'm Judy Ansel.
The Great Railroad Strike of 1922, also known as the Railway Shopman Strike, was the collective action of 400,000 workers, making it one of the largest strikes in United States history. I'm Stephen Hill, and tonight the Heartland Labor Forum is happy to have Colin Davis, professor, researcher, and author, talk about what in July will mark the 100th anniversary of this important event. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. As you well know, this is the centenary of the 1922 railroad strike. I was wondering if you could provide us some context on that.
Yes. It's a very impressive strike. I mean, you got 400,000 workers.
Yeah, 400,000.
400,000 railroad workers.
Right.
That's more than any railroad strike ever before in American history.
Right.
I mean, it's a lot more than a Pullman strike in 1894.
Yeah.
And a lot more than 1877. And this affected every community across the United States. So it reached not wide, but also deep into these railroad towns. A lot of those railroad towns, I mean, they're everywhere.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You've got Needles, I mean, California, you've got Ogden, Utah. I really got to understand a lot of this sort of geography of America.
Right.
By doing this study, it was part of my dissertation. It was my PhD at the time.
Oh, okay.
And I had an absolute gold mine there at sort of Cornell University at their labor archive. They had all the organizers' reports from every single railroad in the United States.
Really?
On this strike.
Oh, wow.
So they're sending in these daily, sometimes weekly reports about what the local sort of conditions were on these individual, railroads, but sort of railroad systems. So you really got this incredible insight into local conditions across the country.
Yeah.
It was absolutely a huge topic. I remember talking to some of the older sort of labor historians who were asking me, well, which railroad are you doing for the National Railroad Shopman Strike?
Wow.
And I said, I'm doing them all. They went, you're doing them all. And I said, well, it's a national strike.
Yeah.
I did take on quite a bit.
Was there anything that was homogenous from all these different locations?
Yeah, actually, there were. I think the railroad towns themselves, as opposed to a city, you know, like Buffalo or San Francisco, where these sort of railroad shopmen were part of a larger group of working class, steel workers and what have you. but it's in the railroad towns, you know, the Carbondale, Illinois, you know, those sorts of places, right, where they had an enormous amount of influence on the local politics of those towns.
Okay.
These were skilled workers, I mean, boilermakers, sheet metal workers, they were machinists, electricians. There were six crafts.
Okay.
They were upstanding sort of members of the community, I mean, skilled workers, yeah, fairly well off. They're certainly not middle class. I mean, they're still working class, but you know, they had status in their communities. And that went right around the country. So whether it is in Washington State, D.C., and that also just translated into having sort of political power.
Okay.
And that meant in many cases, and this is very unique to the American situation,
yeah,
is that sheriffs, local sheriffs, are voted in by the citizenry.
Oh, really?
So in many cases, yeah. And so in many cases, these sheriffs were there to represent these strikers. So when the railroads would try to import, hired gunmen, basically, as well as strike breakers, they were met in many cases by these local sheriffs and their deputies, and were basically kind of shunted aside and just told to stay within the yards, don't come into town. Because when they came into town, these strike breakers, wherever they were, or these gunmen, the local townspeople would just literally sort of refuse to serve them. So they wouldn't serve them food in a diner, or they couldn't get a haircut in the barbershop. And this shows you the strength that these shopmen, these railroad shopmen, had in their local communities. And of course, you had other railroad workers who were not involved in the strike,
right,
who were also in these communities. So you had the engineers, the firemen, the conductors, you had the maintenance away people, you had the telegraph people. You know, they shunned all of these people who were sort of perceived as invaders.
Oh,
and in some respects, they were invaders.
So I get the sense that at the time, there was a fair amount of division between the different crafts within the railroad, like the shopmen themselves are not the engineers.
Right.
The events around here helped them to maybe see that perhaps that they could have greater unity than what they had before.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's certainly something that they wanted. Okay. The big issue for the shopmen was what were the sort of the operating brotherhood's going to do. I mean, the brotherhoods were, you know, these are the engineers, the firemen, the conductors. I mean, they were the aristocracy.
Okay.
In the rail, or the labor aristocracy in the railroad industry.
Okay.
And these guys had enormous power. I mean, all they had to do was go on strike, and then the whole system would just collapse overnight.
Okay.
The problem for the railroad shopmen were, you know, because they built, but they maintained the rolling stock, it was going to take weeks, if not months, for this strike to really take effect, you know, where the actual rolling stock would start to break down. It's very difficult. Yes, you can get strike breakers off the streets in Chicago or in San Francisco or in New York, wherever, but they can't do this job. They don't know how to operate these huge lathes, you know, like a machinist does. They don't know how to use oxygen acetylene, you know, like a sort of blacksmith does, or like a sheet metal worker does.
Right.
And so, you know, the shopmen had these skills, but the problem is that when they went on strike, the impact of the strike is not immediate.
Oh, okay.
And so it's going to take time. It's going to take time.
Because the rolling stock's going to continue to work for a bit.
Until it starts to break down, as it all does.
Yeah.
And then there's no one to repair it. Yes, you've got some scabs who sort of stayed on the job, or you've got strike breakers moving around, but they really can't do the job as well as the sort of shopmen. So the big issue was, as these trains become increasingly unsafe, would the operating brotherhoods, the engineers and the firemen, would they just say, enough is enough, we can't operate this rolling stock because it's unsafe, we're going to join the strike? Now, that was what the shopmen wanted, of course, because then that would have an immediate impact on this strike.
It became very real for everybody.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But that didn't happen. It took 2 months. The strike started on, July the 1st, 1922.
Yeah.
But by September, that's when the rolling stock was basically falling apart.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And that's when the strike was really beginning to bite. This is when you got Herbert Hoover, who is the Secretary of Commerce under Harding's administration. He's going around trying to organize peace agreement, some sort of negotiation. Okay. He met with the railroad presidents, some of the big guys, really, really big guys. He also met with bankers, Wall Street bankers, because these railroad systems are basically owned by banks. It's part of that kind of merchant capitalism in some respects, or finance capitalism. So he even met with bankers, and the bankers just told Herbert Hoover to go away. Herbert Hoover, described them as pharaohs who lived in another era.
Oh, wow.
But it's clear that the railroad presidents were not going to, they weren't going to budge. Not going to budge. And then the government had to decide what to do next. Because the railroad system under, direct threat after 2 months, that means that the whole national, economy is under direct threat. The railroads were the lifeblood.
Right.
They were just like the interstate system is today. The railroads were the lifeblood, the economic lifeblood of the nation.
Yeah.
And so it's at that point that they decided to break this strike. This is the federal government.
You're listening to the Heartland Labor Forum. The railroad workers and other unions as well benefited a lot from World War One.
Yes.
I think under Wilson, they had very favorable political conditions as well. And then all of a sudden, all of those gains are becoming, they're getting wiped out, essentially.
It's very true. Because during the war, World War One, the government wanted the railway system to work. You've got, everything's going east. Mainly it's going east because that's where the troops are going, because then they're heading on to Europe. That's where all the arms, the ammunition, the guns went. It was going east. And the problem was is that the railroad companies, they couldn't coordinate this flow. So what you had was congestion. In 1917, the system was basically nearly coming to a halt.
It's
at that point in 1917 that the federal government took, direct control, not ownership, but direct control of the railroads.
Oh, okay.
They were going to sort of coordinate all of this, and they're very successful at that because the individual railroads, they're all competitors. They couldn't arrange it. They couldn't figure out how to do it without, upsetting their shareholders or whatever. But the government said, we don't care about shareholders. We're fighting a war. And so that's why the government, took over. But at the same time, while they're taking over, the last thing that the government wanted was strikes. Anything that would interrupt the flow.
Sure.
And of course, this was a war, Wilson's 14 points, fighting for, democracy.
Yeah.
So the government couldn't do what it did in, previous strikes, like the Pullman strike in 1894. The government couldn't, break strikes and throw workers in prison because we're fighting a war for democracy. It doesn't look good. if you're supposed to be fighting this war for democracy, but you're putting workers in prison.
Right, yeah. So,
what the government sort of decided to do was to give the railroad workers whatever they wanted. Oh. And for the shopmen in particular, who were organizing up until this point, but they'd already organized about 40% of the shop workforce. Overnight, the government gave them the right to form a union, and then began to actually just negotiate with those unions and give them pay rises. So there's like a flip of the switch. The government gives all of these railroads, and it's not just the shopmen, it's the maintenance of way guys. It's the actual track workers who are basically not giving anything. But, and then all of a sudden, we don't want these guys on strike either.
No, because you got to have the tracks. Yeah, the whole system. Yeah.
And you've got, 2 million railroad workers in 1918. 2 million.
Wow.
That is a lot. That dwarfs the number of steel workers and coal miners in the nation. So, but they want to keep them happy. So, yes, they get that. But the war is over in 1918.
Mm.
And that's when you get that kind of pushback and you have a series of strikes, 1918, 1919, against the coal miners, amongst others, textile workers.
Yeah.
But the shopmen were protected by this government thing. And then they passed the 1920 Transportation Act, which kind of codified their sort of power. This is the power of the shopmen and other railway workers. 1920 Transportation Act. So they got some sort of protection. Okay. But by 1921, 1922, the railroads or the owners are really pushing hard, series of wage cuts, you know, really cutting deep. And it was that final wage cut in 1922 that forced the shopmen to go out on strike on July the 1st.
I see. So there was a sea change at the government level with the Harding administration.
Harding, the first of a string of Republican presidents.
Okay. Okay. So we have some parallels with that today. It'd be lovely if we could learn from history. I think it's kind of amazing that the government was doing a great job running the railroad.
Yeah.
It's one of the pro-business arguments is that the government can't run anything. it turns out they can.
I saw a witness it here. I mean, I'm in Norway.
Oh, right.
I mean, I catch the train quite often, and you know, it's all owned by the government, and it works. It's all on time, and it's very clean. It's very efficient. So this notion that the government can't do this is really a fallacy, to say the least.
It's a pro-business kind of tactic, perhaps. What was the role of women during all this? I imagine
huge
during the war that they occupied some of those labor positions, but then once
they
the war was over, okay.
They did. They came into the workshops. Yeah. They came in as machinists. They came in as blacksmiths and sheet metal workers. Now, there were many of these male shopmen who were not happy about it. Right. They were fearful that these women were going to be used as a wedge by the employers to, de-skill the positions and the cuts in wages. But you had this same sort of idea in World War II as well. But again, this is a fallacy. You know, there's a shortage of labor, especially, you need these workshops to be run. Or these railroad shops we run. Yeah, so there were. There weren't huge numbers. In World War II, there were a lot more.
Okay.
Because the war was only really about 2 years.
The first one, 1918.
I mean, it didn't start until 17. But yes, women did come in to the shops, but after the war, they were shunned to the side. But during the strike itself, critical. The ladies' auxiliaries, that's what they were called, were just absolutely brilliant at organizing the townspeople, doing benefits. And this is where all these organizers' reports are coming in that I read that I housed at Sol Cornell. Time after time, just countless numbers of these reports are just applauding this work of these, female auxiliaries, how well they're doing. And what I noticed, I did one article where I was comparing, two southern railroads. They were parallel railroads. One was the Seaboard Airline, and the other one was the Atlantic, coastline. They were around right up until the 60s, I think. But one of them, the Seaboard Airline, really had a very dynamic female presence in that strike. And that's what led to their success. The Atlantic coastline did not really, it got there a little bit late, just realizing the value of women in this strike. And so what you see with that parallel rail, they are literally parallel rail, geographic rail. They're running from Washington all the way down into Florida, all the way down the East Coast. And the Seaboard Airline, again, organized its women, or in many cases, the women organized themselves. They're not waiting around for men to do this. This is great. But on the Atlantic coastline, a little hesitant, they're not quite sure what to do. And so that weakened their response. So the Seaboard Airline was a much more successful strike, even though they're in the same towns and cities going through the South. But again, the key here is the involvement of women.
So perhaps solidarity across communities would be a key thing to think about.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. It really is. It's just remarkable.
Well, that's fascinating. I feel like there's so much more we could cover. I wish we had more time. And Colin, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me.
Anytime, Steve. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and I wish you continued success.
Thanks very much. Yeah.
I feel all so blue. I really don't know what to do. I got a brand new job, a tip collector, it's some job, a cop protector, since I left my home and started on railroads to roam. I get nothing but abuse, so tell me what's the use. It's for my quota, draft on my feet. It's for my quota, tied on the heat. It's for my quota, all the live long day.
Every summer, Union Women's Summer Schools take place in the West, South, Midwest, and Northeast, developing skills for women to grow their leadership in their unions and organizations. Find your voice, develop your skills, and realize sisterhood and solidarity at a school sponsored by the United Association for Labor Education. Find out about the 2022 Union Women's Summer Schools at uale.org. This is Emily Twarog of UALE. Thank you.
Tune in every Saturday at 5 p.m. for Changing Narratives, a program hosted by me, Brother Jay. Join me for interviews and discussions that will be informative and entertaining. While interviewing some of the unsung heroes from the African-American community, our goal is to bring balance to the negative narratives that are currently being shared. Once again, every Saturday at 5 p.m., Changing Narratives with Brother Jay.
Tell your smart speaker, play KKFI, and enjoy the programming you love. KKFI can be wherever you are.
And we're back. You're listening to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Mark Galis. Abigail Washburn and Bela Fleck with Railroad. Railroad unions have been at the bargaining table for 2 years now, seeking higher wages and better working conditions for their members, as well as fighting the move from two to one-person crews on trains. Railroad companies have aggressively opposed and resisted the union's efforts, despite record profits during the pandemic. Where do the current negotiations stand? Joining us is Brent Leonard, Transportation Division Vice President, International Representative and General Vice President for Smart TD. Brent, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Could you give us your background in the railroad industry?
Sure. So I come from a family of railroad workers, fourth generation to do it. Pretty much all the men in my family, immediate family, worked for the railroad. I started with Union Pacific in 1997 in Denver, Colorado, as a switchman brakeman. And very quickly, within a few months, I became a locomotive engineer. I ran primarily from Denver. I chose to work the route from Denver, Colorado to Cheyenne, Wyoming. We also ran to Western Kansas and then up to the coal fields in the high country of Colorado. I became a union officer in 2001, local union officer. That came about kind of in an interesting way. The individuals that were running for the position, I kind of thought, I don't know if I want these guys to be my representative. And I thought, well, I better put my money where my mouth is. And if I think I can do better, I stepped up and here I am today as the what we used to call assistant president. So I report directly to the president of the transportation division at SMART. Kind of went through all the different levels, local, regional, now international for a few years now. So that's kind of where I got my start.
Most of our listeners are familiar with trade and craft unions who are covered by the National Labor Relations Act, but it turns out that railroads, as well as airlines, are governed by something else called the Railway Labor Act. Could you talk to us about the Railway Labor Act and whether there are special bargaining rules, or does government play a bigger role with respect to that act?
Yeah, so the Railway Labor Act, at the risk of sounding like a high school history teacher here, the Railway Labor Act was born, officially born in the 1920s, I think 26 to be exact. And really what gave birth to it was, at that time, the railroads were really the primary mode of transportation for everything in the country. It was literally the lifeblood of the country, with all the different pods of the union throughout the country. There were multiple railroad unions representing operating employees, what we call operating employees, the guys who run the trains. There was just tremendous labor strife throughout the country, where a railroad in Chicago would either lock out employees, the union would strike, and it would cripple the country, cripple the economy. Labor and management came together and said, this is madness. We've got to end this. And they actually came up with the terms or provisions of the Railway Labor Act. Congress enacted it. And it's been amended a few times over the last 100 years. Its function is to provide guidance in the bargaining process and the outline for our resolution of disputes, as well as, certification for representation of the unions, union shop, closed shop, that kind of stuff. So yeah, it's a very interesting, kind of unique. It's for railroads and airlines. There's a few subtle differences between railroad and airline. I would say the big advantage to the Railway Labor Act that a lot of people, even our members, may not immediately recognize is that our mediation, our arbitration for any dispute, no matter how small, how large, it's all paid for by the federal government. The benefit there for a member is it doesn't matter how seemingly insignificant the dispute or grievance may be, that member is going to get his or her day in court, essentially. And we actually have our own court, per se. It's called the National Railway Adjustment Board. It's located in Chicago, and we adjudicate grievances there. There's other forms of arbitration that we can do outside of that little special court. But it's unique and extremely beneficial in that way.
Let's talk a little about collective bargaining. When people think of collective bargaining under National Labor Relations Act, they normally think of bargaining between one union and one employer, or perhaps in the case of Major League Baseball or other professional sports, one union and multiple employers. But the railroad industry does it differently. Could you explain that?
Yeah, so going back again 100 years, somewhere around the time of Railway Labor Act being enacted, the industry, both labor and management, saw a benefit in doing, at that time it was more regional, Northeast, so forth, so on, regional agreements that established an equal or, a flat rates of pay for regardless of what railroad you worked for. Of course, health and welfare really was not an issue back then. It wasn't even contemplated, I guess. But throughout, I guess, up to starting somewhere in the 30s, we went to this national agreement where the railroads enjoyed that because it eliminates, it levels the playing field for them as a business against competing against other railroads, at least with their labor structure. Same thing for us. We prevent any type of race to the bottom scenario amongst our regional groups in establishing, rates of pay across the country. So it's unique in that.
So as I understand it, you have the National Rail Contract, right? That's the main agreement?
Yeah. The way our agreements or collective bargaining agreements are structured is we have a national agreement. It covers or encompasses primarily rates of pay, health and welfare benefit, and maybe some just very broad high-level work rule issues. That's what they govern. The regional agreements then, or local agreements as we call them, they get into a lot more minutiae of how work rules, discipline rules, things like that. They can amend pay in certain ways, but they don't deviate too far in pay. But they can do that. And you know, one of the interesting things about the agreements under the Railway Labor Act is that they don't expire. The Railway Labor Act, our agreements are essentially forever, permanent. Unless specified within the CBA itself, or they're amended with a subsequent agreement at some point.
That's very interesting, because under the National Labor Relations Act, of course, most collective bargaining agreements have a shelf life of 3 years or 5 years or whatever it might be. So with respect to the national agreement you're talking about, I imagine that the national agreement, the two sides are, you know, a coalition of unions and a coalition of carriers, including most, if not all, of the major railroads, most, if not all, of the major rail unions. Is that how the local agreements are negotiated as well, or is that more particular to individual unions?
Yeah, so that brings up a great point, and something that right now I think all of rail labor is very proud about. So previous to this round, we're currently in a round of national bargaining on a couple of fronts, but previous, so we have, you know, earlier in the interview, I referred to operating crafts. Those are the men and women that operate the trains. But, you know, there's a huge support structure at the railroad that keeps those trains running. You have maintenance away craft, which repairs the track. You have the signalman craft, which do the trackside signaling systems. You have what we call shop crafts. There's a whole host of shop crafts, which sheet metal workers are in there, boiler makers, pipe fitters, machinists, firemen and oilers. I apologize if I left anyone out, but there's a lot of them in the shops that keep the equipment operating. Carmen that are repairing the rail cars. Previous round and this round of national bargaining, the typical process was each union engaged with multiple carriers or railroad carriers in a national agreement. And they structured, or they collectively bargained for an agreement for their craft. And the great Eugene Debs, he back in the early 1900s saw the benefit of all the crafts coming together at the railroad and bargaining together. It took us over 100 years. Now, we are not merged as a single union, of course, but this round of bargaining that we're currently in, we're successfully able, all the unions came together and we created the largest coalition bargaining unit ever in the history of rail labor. We have all crafts, all unions at the railroad in the room together as a coalition. There are a couple that are not, but yeah, it was a huge success, and it was a great moment for rail labor that we were, Eugene Debs' vision was able finally to come to fruition in a way, maybe 120 years late, but here we are.
With respect to the bargaining, I think you mentioned it's been going on for a couple of years now at the national level. What are the main issues that are involved in this current bargaining session?
So this round of bargaining, which began in the beginning of 2020, January 1st, 2020, railroads served notice on the labor organizations in late 2019. And SMART-TD, I guess we got singled out in this one. And we're actually fighting battles on two fronts. So we're, as part of the coalition, bargaining coalition, we're fighting for, you know, the wages and benefits. And the railroads are seeking probably the most aggressive concessions from labor that we, any of us have seen in our careers, and even the leaders that in the other organizations that are like older than myself and have been doing this twice as long as I have, are saying the same thing. They've never seen such an aggressive move against labor in this round. The second front, that this is where Smart TD is, we're on our own on this. Now, we, of course, have the full support and backing of our fellow unions in rail. But the railroads are seeking to move to more automated trains, and they want to eliminate conductors from the train crew. Today, you have one engineer, one conductor, sometimes a brakeman on every train. And technology has, the railroads believe technology today allows them to eliminate the position of conductor. So we are fighting that one separately from the national table. So two fronts.
My guess is that the automation would do two things. One, it would decrease union jobs. And the other is it would decrease safety.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, when it comes to the elimination of the conductor, there's just a whole host of problems. And, you know, I'm kind of at the forefront of that. And, you know, the technology and where it's at on these trains, it is amazing technology, no doubt, but it's far from perfected. You know, they want to fundamentally restructure the operation. And there's just so many questions regarding how this could be safely implemented, safely conducted. And right now we're all experiencing a time where, you know, we want our Amazon Prime package in 2 days and we're waiting 2 weeks maybe, or that part for your car that you need to repair it. It's unavailable for the next 3 months, and it might be sitting in a container ship in the port of LA for extended periods of time because the railroad can't move it. You know, we don't think it's in the public interest to attempt some grand experiment of redesigning railroad operation, which could really adversely impact the public interest right now, particularly. But you know, the railroads are seeking, you know, they're out for the money is what they're looking at. Money.
All of this is happening with railroads making, in some cases, record profits. Isn't that right?
That's right. You know, the railroads are enjoying an incredibly profitable period. They've made significant reductions in workforce and capital investment. You know, we wonder how sustainable that type of model is. Yet they're coming at us and all of labor for just these incredible reductions and concessions.
Is there a certain timetable in place to finish negotiations or to have an amended national contract?
Yeah. So going back to the Railway Labor Act, the act itself specifies our bargaining process and what happens with impasse. And the act, as I explained earlier, the act was really designed to create stability in the industry and, you know, strikes, work, you know, lockouts, things like that. And so what the act, essentially in a nutshell, the way the act works is you the two sides will bargain. If one party feels they're at impasse, then they go to what's the National Mediation Board, and they appoint federal mediator to the process. That's the point that we're in now, is in federal mediation on the both fronts. We are in the mediation phase. At a certain point, it's up to the mediator and the NMB to decide if the parties continue to be at an impasse. What happens then when they determine you're at impasse is you go through a series of, well, there's a proffer for arbitration to settle it, binding arbitration. That is not a common thing. Most sides don't usually want to go to the arbitration. So there's this period of cooling off periods, and ultimately then it goes to self-help. And self-help is lockout or strike. In the past, when it's gotten to that point, usually the White House intervenes. and you know, to affect the economy, things like that, a national rail strike. So very quickly, the White House will intervene, order the workers back to work, and the White House establishes what's called a presidential emergency board. He establishes a board. It's appointed by the president of the White House. So, of course, both sides are very keen to be aware of who's in the White House and who the White House is most friendly to when those boards are established. The board is established. It could be anybody, but generally it is rail arbitrators, rail experts, industry experts, and they hear both sides. They write a recommendation for resolution, and it's a non-binding recommendation. If either party does not accept the recommendation of the PEB or PE board, at that point, then it goes back to self-help, lockout or strike. Now, congressional intervention occurs, and Congress will usually, well, has always ordered the parties back to work, and then Congress will then come up and they will legislate a solution. History showed us what Congress usually does is they just rubber stamp the recommendation of the PE board. So that's what you get in the end.
Are you hopeful that that will be avoided this time around?
You know, we're always hopeful. Rail labor experienced, all crafts, not just ours, but all crafts experienced during the Reagan administration and then the H.W. Bush administration, some significant setbacks from presidential emergency boards then. So that generation of labor leader in our unions were, of course, very, very reluctant to allow things to go to that point. And of course, we remain reluctant because, you know, you look at Congress today and what Congress can't seem to figure anything out or do anything. You don't know what you're going to get. You know, that's the political process. So we're always hopeful, but I think it's safe to say in this round, we're hoping for the best and preparing for the worst.
Well, on that note, I wish you luck as you go through the bargaining process. Hopefully, as we move down the road, we can have you back to fill us in on how bargaining is going and how the national contract ends up. Brent Leonard, Transportation Division Vice President and International Representative and General Vice President for Smart TD, thank you for joining us.
All right.
When the union's inspiration through the workers' blood shall run, there can be no power greater.
And on the phone with us from Washington is Mark Grunberg. How you doing, Mark?
Fine, thanks very much.
Okay, we're having a little technical problem, but I hope everybody can hear you fine. So you have an article this week on Workers' Memorial Day, which is, of course, today. And it's interestingly, the AFL-CIO published its annual report. This one is the 31st annual Death on the Job report. They had a worker from the Amazon warehouse in Bessemer, Alabama, talk about his safety conditions at work. Tell us what work is like for this guy.
Well, actually, we had two Bessemer workers, one with them and one with the National Council of Occupational Safety and Health the next day. And the short answer is it's awful. Inside of that warehouse, there are toxic fumes. There are dangers in moving things. There's speed ups. There's all sorts of bad conditions inside that warehouse. And those bad conditions. Oh, and they didn't bother to tell the workers if any of their colleagues got sick from the coronavirus. So six people have died in the 2 years, not necessarily from the virus, but six have died in the 2 years since that warehouse is open. All this was a great factor in persuading the workers to try to unionize.
I see. Well, you know, one of the things that you had in this article was that they stand for 12 hours on their shift and they only get a 30-minute break during that 12 hours. That's got to have a lot of health effects on those workers.
Right. And then the next worker, the one who spoke at the second session the next day, said that on one of 30-minute breaks, one of the workers, and this was, she observed this, was found unconscious in front of the bathroom.
Oh, my.
And he was one of those who died.
Wow.
And I never knew his name.
Wow.
They wouldn't tell him his name.
So you also, in this article, talk about the report that the AFL-CIO just issued called Death on the Job. What were some of the most striking statistics? Because that report had a lot of statistics. What were some of the most striking ones that you recall?
Some of the most striking statistics, actually, were that while the death rate went down slightly, it's not so much that, and so did the numbers. The reason why is because the hours worked by nationwide went down by 10%. It's called the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
So the pandemic sort of skewed everything. And the report points that out. The other, of course, is that the death rate for workers and injury rates for workers of color, black and brown workers, was much higher than that of other workers.
Why is that?
They're in more dangerous jobs, in so many words.
Mm-hmm. So I know a lot of Latinos work in construction.
Right.
And those folks regularly are falling off roofs because they don't have proper safety training mm-hmm. and equipment. You know, one of the things...
Which reminds me one more thing.
Yeah.
Another story we did this week, Arizona. The National OSHA is about to go after Arizona and yank their state program from them. And one reason why, this was when Arizona first started, you know, going off the rails, pardon the expression, was the state legislature 10 years ago decided, okay, you don't have to protect the construction worker until the platform's 15 feet above the ground, not 6.
Oh, my.
Yes.
So if they take away Arizona's license to cover its own health and safety, then OSHA would take jurisdiction and to protect workers in Arizona. Is that correct?
Correct, yes.
Yeah. Okay, one last statistic because we're just about out of time. 340 workers every day die from hazardous working conditions. That's really something. That's all I can say.
Okay, just to clarify that statistic, that includes not just those who died on the job, but those who died from past illnesses.
I see.
That they got on the job, like black lung and silicosis.
Okay. Well, we're out of time, Mark. Thank you very much, and we'll talk to you next month. That was Mark Greenberg with Washington Window on Workers. And that's it for tonight's show. Tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. How do you do international solidarity the right way? We're going to be talking about the United Electrical Workers Authentic Workers Front Partnership in Mexico, and we're also going to be talking about rank choice voting in Kansas City. The Heartland Labor Forum is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Check out the rich diversity of programming related to workers and unions at laborradionetwork.org. Thanks to our engineers tonight, Megan Pfeiffer and Patricia Doherty. And stay tuned for their first show. It's Rhythm and Soul. That's K-pop soul.
Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss. And you can talk back to us, too. Send us your feedback, your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforum@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming ones, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on this show are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening at 6 or to our rebroadcast Friday mornings at 5 right here, 90.1 FM.
We still got our pride, 'cause we are the working class, and that's the place to be.